Welcome to the Blood Cancer Experience, a podcast by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Canada. This podcast connects people affected by a blood cancer to resources that inform, support, educate, and empower. When it comes to cancer, it's hard to navigate the unknown and there are no easy answers. We're here to bring you the information you need to help make sense of every step of the blood cancer experience. My name is Charlotte Hall Coates, and I'm the Community Services Manager for the Atlantic Region. Today on the show, I am talking to Dr. Sharon Abish about pediatric blood cancer and what it's like working in this field. Dr. Abish attended McGill Medical School in Montreal and then completed pediatric training at the IWK Health Center in Halifax, as well as a fellowship in pediatric hematology and oncology in New York at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Welcome, Dr. Abish.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to participate.
So to get us started, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your role in pediatric hematology oncology?
Sure. So I've been working at the Montreal Children's Hospital for many years now, and I look after children, and that being from almost birth until 18 years old and then sometimes older, with a wide variety of conditions, both benign hematology and leukemia and lymphoma. I also am running the long-term follow-up program where I follow up people who were treated as children for childhood cancers but are now have off therapy for at least 5 years, and many of whom are adults.
Wow, that's so interesting. So kind of going back to the beginning of your career, what made you decide to pursue a career in pediatric oncology?
Well, I was very fortunate during the time that I was doing my training in pediatrics to work with several families who were struggling with the diagnosis and the treatment, and it was a real privilege to be able to help them through this, what was obviously a very difficult time. And also at the same time, there were incredible advances being made in both the diagnosis and the treatment of the children's cancer, which made it a really exciting opportunity to be involved in this rapidly changing field.
Yeah, that absolutely. So thinking about sort of day-to-day work with children, what's that like?
Well, as you can imagine, it's different every day, which is one of the things that I really love about my job. Because children are dealing with these things at different ages, you can imagine that sometimes we're dealing with infants and they can't tell us what's going on, so we really have to try to use every clue that we have, sometimes with young children, sometimes with teenagers, but always with the entire family who are surrounding them. So these bring challenges as well as joys.
For sure. So you just mentioned challenges. Can you talk a little bit about the specific challenges, young people, children who are who receive a cancer diagnosis experience?
The challenges are for the children themselves, their parents, as well as for all the staff that are around them. It's a real shock. A parent expects that their child is going to be diagnosed with cancer, and every parent has a sense of powerlessness and guilt for allowing this kind of thing to happen to their children. So it's a period of great stress. It's a period of a lot of upheavals and challenges for the families in terms of their other children they may have to care for at the same time, in terms of work that they have to negotiate, in terms of understanding what's being told to them, and in terms of trying to support their children through this very difficult time. So we're lucky that we have a team around us who can help us in supporting the family, including social workers, the nurses, the psychologists, child life workers, a whole group of people really who are trying to support the family and the children as best they can during a very difficult time.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, having that sort of support network is so important to not only the children, but their whole family.
Absolutely.
So in your experience, what do you find is the best way to communicate with either the child or the parents or even the whole family as a unit regarding their diagnosis and treatment?
I think we have to remember that this is a big shock to the entire family, and very often it's difficult for them to hear the news you're giving them. So we take it slowly, giving as much information as we absolutely need to give at the beginning, and then remembering to go back to many of the things that we've talked about, because people may not be able to absorb everything that they're hearing at the beginning at a time of shock. In terms of approaching the children, it clearly depends on how old they are and how easily it is to engage them in what we need to do. Some children are very cooperative all the time. Most children are not. And we need to take into account what developmental stage they're at as well when we do this.
Yeah, for sure. Do you find there is a big difference between, you know, younger children receiving a diagnosis versus, you know, maybe older children or teens, or is it really, you know, based on the individual?
It's totally different. I find with young children, if they're feeling well, then everything's fine. If they're not feeling well, then those are the moments that are hard. But the older the child gets and the more understanding they have about what's going on, there are a lot of other emotional aspects to what they're going through. They've been isolated from their friends. They can no longer go to school. A lot of the teenagers are dealing with the fact that they were just approaching a time when they were gaining independence and separating themselves more from their family, relying more on their peer group for their support and their enjoyment. And suddenly this is taken away from them, and we need to expect that there's going to be some rebellion.
Very interesting. Yeah, that must be such a difficult age. I every age is difficult, but I, you know, it's hard to imagine, you know, when you're such a young person. So you spoke of some of the challenges that children and their parents face after receiving a blood cancer diagnosis, but can you talk to us a little bit about the challenges that you face trying to treat a blood cancer in a child?
Sure. As you can well imagine, it's not an easy field to be in, and we're often the bearers of bad news. And one of the important things is to be patient and to allow families to vent their emotions and to remember that it's not directed exactly against us. We just are the messengers. And often if we are patient with that and get through that period of time, we can gain trust and really make a difference in the way that families can accept what we've just told them. It's emotional, and often we find ourselves dealing with our emotions as well. Many of us are parents, and it's impossible to completely separate what's going on at work with our home lives. So sometimes it's hard not to bring home some of those emotions.
Yeah, I bet it must be, you know, heavy sometimes, you know, having to go through that experience along with the families.
Yes. And COVID, of course, makes everything just a little bit more complicated.
Of course, absolutely. So you talked about some of the challenges, but, you know, at the beginning when you were introducing yourself, you also mentioned some of the joys or benefits of working with children and families. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, some of those specific benefits and joys?
Absolutely. So working with children, as I mentioned before, when children are feeling well, all is good. And I think we have to take some of our cues from them. Near the beginning, parents often ask me, how can I possibly be happy? How can I possibly enjoy myself when I'm watching my child go through all of this? And usually one of the things I tell them is, look at your child. And if your child is able to play and enjoy and laugh with their friends, then we need to watch that. And we need to learn from that and take joy from that as well. It's also a great It's a real joy to watch children overcome their fears and master some of the things that we're asking of them, and to watch families learn to grapple with many, many difficult things. They often will say to me, I don't know how I'm going to go through this. And it's quite amazing how parents manage to rise to the challenge and really do everything in their power to make this experience for their children less difficult. One of the biggest joys I have is in the long-term follow-up program, when I can see young adults who've been through this experience as children and see them going on with their lives and really thriving. They have a lot to teach us. They have a lot to teach their peers. And I think they have a lot to teach everybody about how to overcome some difficult times and to learn from them and use it going forward.
So you mentioned follow-up, and that sounds like it's a very important part of your role. Can you talk a little bit more about what happens when someone finishes treatment? What does the follow-up plan look like?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I like to tell people is everybody looks forward to the day that they finish treatment, but we also have to remember that there is some anxiety that comes with that, and that takes some people by surprise. The kids are always very excited to be finished, but the parents often find that there was a little bit of support in getting the treatments. There was a little bit of less worry as long as you knew that your child was still receiving treatment. And when you take that away, sometimes there's some anxiety that comes with that. So I like to prepare people for that feeling. But after they finish treatment, we continue to follow all patients. And the frequency of visits gets a little bit spaced out depending on how long they are from completing therapy. But even when people are 5 years from completing therapy, we're still trying to see everybody at least one time a year to follow up, make sure that there's no long-term effects of the diagnosis itself and of the treatment they received, and to make sure that we're addressing any questions that they may have and transferring that information to the patient themselves. Because as you recall, some of the children are very young at the time of the diagnosis, and they may really not have absorbed very much about what was going on. And it's really important by the time they reach adulthood that they have taken this on as their own story, that they understand enough to be able to transmit that information to a physician in the future and to understand whether or not there are any implications for the rest of their lives. So education is a really important part of that transition to adulthood. And we also talk a lot about healthy lifestyle. They can't control what happened to them in the past, but what you can control are any added risk factors that come from lifestyle choices like smoking and sunscreen and all those things that we get tired of hearing but are important for everyone, but doubly important for someone who's already had a cancer diagnosis.
For sure, absolutely. I think that's so important for them to probably take with them later on in life, just making sure you stay as healthy as possible. So you touched upon a little bit some of the you know, really needing to know about the late or long-term effects and following up with that. Can you touch a little bit more about what some of those late-term or long-term effects could look like?
When we see patients who have now moved on to the next parts of their lives, what we do is we look back and look at what their diagnosis was, how old they were, what the treatments were, and we use that information to make a plan for follow-up. So depending on what that treatment was, there may be some important follow-ups that need to take place in terms of following their heart function or their kidney function. We may need to discuss fertility issues. We may need to talk about screening that would otherwise not happen until a later age. For example, a young woman who had some radiation therapy that included part of her breast tissue would have to start screening for breast cancer earlier than the general population.
Yeah, those are probably good things for everybody to be aware of who's gone through, you know, cancer treatment is, you know, just being aware of things that may arise in the future.
So part of our role as well is to educate family physicians, who will end up being the primary care physicians for many of these patients, that the past history may be significant, and to inform them, number one, of where they can get that information and what other things need to be looked for in these patients.
So one of the challenges that you sort of touched upon before was children returning to school and how, you know, challenging that can be, especially emotionally challenging for both the child and the parent. So what are some of the ways that you kind of create a smoother transition?
Well, I think that number one, both the child and the parents need to understand that it may be a gradual process, that things don't change from one day to the next and everything is going to be fine the next day. It sometimes takes quite a while for children to have the same energy that they had before, and we may need to do a slower integration to school rather than going back completely. Children also have to deal with peers who are not always the nicest, and teaching them some tools in order to deal with perhaps some teasing and perhaps some misunderstanding. We do some education programs with schools as well to prepare the teachers for what they may have to deal with in school. Another big part of that is the anxiety that parents feel when they're sending their children back out into the world, because the time that they spend with their children is such an intense and such a close period of time that it kind of interrupts that normal separation that happens as children get older and transfer the importance of their family somewhat to their friends. And sometimes it's very hard to get back onto that trajectory of moving on and separating a bit from your family. I think that we try really hard in early adolescence to start that process by starting to see the children or adolescents on their own, although their parents come and then come in after. We try to give them some time to talk alone, to see us alone, so that they start taking ownership of their own medical issues. And it works both ways, is starting to teach the parents that, yes, you've been there for them, but they need to do some of this on their own.
For sure. And to kind of wrap us up, can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, what's on the horizon in terms of the future pediatric blood cancer? This could be, you know, in terms of treatment or diagnostic tools, or like what do you see, or what makes you excited about, you know, what's coming down the pipe?
It is a very exciting time. So if you look back, we used to think leukemia was leukemia. And over the years, we've learned to delve much deeper into the leukemia, both at the time of diagnosis and then during therapy. And this information has been very, very important to help us tailor the treatment a little bit more for each individual patient. And I think that's going to become more and more prevalent, in that we'll be able to understand and not treat all patients the same, but treat them more specifically for their own leukemia. And then not only in terms of the actual treatment, but in terms of the supportive care that we can offer. We have much better control of side effects like nausea and vomiting, many more tools to deal with pain and to deal with sleeplessness and to deal with all of those side effects that come along with it. And I think that we also are learning more about how other genes and other parts of our body affect the way that we tolerate chemotherapy. So even within one medication, we may hopefully learn to adjust the dose depending on how patients are going to tolerate it. So it's a really very exciting time. We're learning more about targeting only the cancer cells and decreasing the side effects on the rest of the body. And I'm hoping that we're going to look back and say, not sure why we were doing that, because now we know things much, you know, in a much better way.
Oh, that's great. That's really exciting to hear. You know, those types of advancements are up and coming, and yeah, I think it's going to be really important and beneficial to patients. So thank you so much, Dr. Abish, for taking the time to talk with us today. If listeners have any questions about pediatric blood cancer or need help navigating your experience, I encourage you to connect with the community services manager in your region. You can also visit bloodcancers.ca to connect with us. Until next time, stay well.
This podcast was made possible thanks to the support of Novartis. Thank you for listening to the Blood Cancer Experience podcast series by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Canada. You can find us wherever you access your favorite podcasts, so be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. If you have an idea for the show, We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email with your comments or suggestions to canadainfo@lls.org. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Canada is dedicated to funding cutting-edge research and supporting people affected by blood cancers. To learn more and access resources including fact sheets, booklets, and webcasts, visit llscanada.org.